The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The case now at the center of a national debate over gun violence. Rittenhouse's supporters say he tried to stop rioters. But for the girlfriend of Anthony Huber, the second man Rittenhouse shot and killed, the trial is about accountability. Rittenhouse says he acted in self-defense. His defense team has been working with a high-profile jury consultant who also worked on the O.J. Simpson trial. Again, day two of jury deliberations is set to begin later this morning.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was NBC reporting on the latest updates around the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Of course, that's unfolding now in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I don't know about you. I thought the verdict would have come in a much quicker fashion. We're now into 2 days of deliberation. And we'll continue to monitor this for you and give you an update on everything that's now unfolding. So stay with us here and, of course, try to give you the latest as it breaks and give you some perspective on it. We'll get into that coming up here. You're more than welcome to join me anytime, too. You know the number, right? It's 888-914-9149. It's always good to talk with you and have you here. You might remember at the end of September when the National School Boards Association wrote a letter to the White House. They were asking for help because of parents who were speaking angrily against their local school board meetings. Well, the fallout from that letter continues. And again, this is just one of those news events I want you to be aware of. I'll continue to cover these events. And we are seeing a difference. I see parents are getting tired of this. Their voices are being heard, and pushback sometimes does result in some positive results. There have been 17 state school boards that were dissatisfied, they disaffiliated themselves from the national group. And it also came out that the NSBA and the White House collaborated on writing that letter. Now, it also came out that the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, you remember him? He was one of the nominees that Obama wanted for the Supreme Court. Well, he's the AG now, and he wasn't very truthful, it seems, when he testified before Congress that the Justice Department had not done any surveillance of parents as a result of the letter. I find that peculiar. I mean, I really do. You say one thing, and yet you say another. Maggie, what is our number for that audio? Is that number two? Let me play this. Let me share this with you here. There's some news that came out of Fox News when an FBI whistleblower alleged that the Department of Justice did, in fact, use these counterterrorism tactics against the parents. Listen to this.
Republicans want Attorney General Merrick Garland back under oath after a whistleblower says the FBI directed agents to use counterterrorism measures to track parents critical of their school boards. Here to react, Congressman Greg Murphy. Here is the key passage from these whistleblower docs. Quote, the counterterrorism division and criminal division created a threat tag, edu officials, to track instances of related threats. We ask that your officers apply the threat tag to investigations and assessments of threats specifically directed against school board administrators. This is what the FBI was focused on.
And this brings it really to a point that Attorney General Garland basically perjured himself in front of Congress and should really face the consequences before this. You know, the great awakening of what happened in Virginia did because the mama bears woke up and saw what was being done to their children. And that is not wrong for them to speak out. In fact, we read a letter speaking out that that we should have committee meetings talking about what has happened to our children during the pandemic. Why are they being taught the CRT and sex education? Basically bringing the fact home that parents have a right to direct their child's education.
Yeah, you know, that was a pretty powerful indictment talking about perjury there and the fact that they should be indicted. Again, Merrick Garland was not fully truthful when he testified before Congress that the Justice Department had not done surveillance on parents. The FBI, the whistleblower found, as you heard there, a document that shows the FBI actually signed a threat acronym. They assigned this threat acronym to reports about school board issues. And they called the it's called a threat tag. And what the memo does is it requires that agents apply that threat tag, and the threat tag was EDU officials, to all investigations and assessments of threats directed specifically at education officials. So Jim Jordan of Ohio, he wrote that letter. He wrote a letter to Merrick Garland saying that his testimony, you know, hey, I don't know, he was either incomplete or you're misleading us, because the FBI is using a counterterrorism tactic to deal with parents. And I don't know about you. I'm glad my kids are out of school. I say this all of the time. That should be troubling to any parent who is disenchanted with what some of these schools are now doing in terms of what they call education to their children. Some of the things that they pass for education really is indoctrination. And as a parent, they have a right to say, no, I'm the primary educator. I don't like what you're teaching. My children's too young. You know, don't expose them to that during their latency period. Don't do this. They're not terrorists for wanting to defend their children. And this is not Cuba. This is not North Korea. This is not China, right? This is the United States of America, where freedom should ring, right? Parents should be able to get up and tell that those who sit on those education boards what they think and hold them accountable, not be given the hashtag of a domestic terrorist. I love our country, and I'm very hopeful about the future of it. And I just think this is all part of where we are right now, part of this this disorientation that I often refer to. You know, there's a great confusion that has befallen this country. I believe it will get better. I do. And we've got a lot of, you know, mechanisms that can help bring about those changes. And we're seeing some of the fruit of that. But I just, these stories have got it. You have to be aware of them, okay? Don't dismiss them. Don't think it doesn't affect me. You really should be aware of what's unfolding, okay? That's why I bring them to you, just so you are in the know and you can be aware of what your kids or your kids' kids are going to be exposed to. The Biden administration has decided also to suspend enforcement of its mandate for large businesses to require vaccinations of all employees after the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued another stay on the mandate. This is the second one, all right? The second one from a court, and it was issued after OSHA said that, look, they were just going to ignore it. But in another development, all the cases that are being brought on the mandate have been consolidated now into the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals based in Cincinnati. And that happened through a lottery system, and a bunch of ping pong balls were marked with various court numbers on them. And someone randomly chose the Sixth Court to hear those cases. So we'll follow that story for you. Well, one other thing here too, and this is, another important story to follow, the infrastructure bill, right? Because you're going to be paying for it. What are you going to see from it? The infrastructure bill was passed. It had been signed into law. But here's what concerns me. And I think most people are in favor of infrastructure if that's what it's going to be spent on. The other huge spending bill that the Biden administration, a lot of the Democrats are hoping to pass on the back of that bill, the so-called Build Back Better bill, it's still languishing in Congress. However, it does seem as if, you know, to me, this is my read. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I mean, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has been opposed to this multi-trillion-dollar, and that's what it is, a multi-trillion-dollar bill from the start. And he told the Senate the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, look, I got some concerns. I'm worried about this bill. You know, they want to pass it. Schumer says he wants to get it passed before Christmas. They know the window's closing for them. The claim from Democrats, of course, is that, you know, $1.75 trillion, that's going to help. It's going to lower inflation, right? So Manchin, of course, is not convinced by that, and neither are most economists, and even the New York Times is skeptical of that claim as well. Let me share a little bit more with you on that. And Magyar audio for that is, we have Manchin, don't we? Manchin, let me just share for you. Here's what... when he was asked how he felt about the plan to spend all this money on this massive budget bill, Build Back Better, Senator Manchin said he's got a lot of concerns. And here is just a little soundbite we found of him speaking with reporters yesterday when he was asked about it, because he's one of the linchpins in this. I mean, it will fail if he's not on board. I don't see any Republicans getting behind this. The problem we're seeing right now is that inflation is looming. And I think he's got concerns about that as well. Listen.
Your voters want this bill, this big, massive bill right now.
I think my voters in West Virginia, but I don't speak for the whole country. My voters a lot differently, but they're very much concerned. Inflation has hit them extremely hard. They have to drive. Their mileage for driving to work is quite onerous on them. And the cost, they see it every day. Every day they go up and fill up, it's a dollar quarter more a gallon. So they're in $3.29, $3.39. Gallon of milk is now around $4 in many places, and it's taking a toll. And I hear it when I go to the grocery store, or if I go to the gas station, they say, "Are you as mad as I am?" And I says, "Absolutely."
Yeah, and I appreciate that. You just want somebody to represent you, to feel your pain, right? To understand, to represent you, not to dig a hole that we're already in even deeper. I hope we get this right. And again, I say this on a very regular basis because I'm a prayer warrior. I believe in prayer. I spend time in prayer every day. And I hope you will do the same thing. I hope you'll pray for our country. I hope you'll pray that the consciousness of our elected leaders will be illuminated, that they will make good moral decisions, right? I really do. I hope that you'll join me in that prayer. We live in a strange time. I mean, you take a look at what's happening, not just societally, not just in terms of the attack on faith, not just on this move towards, big government, larger socialistic type of platforms. We know where that ultimately leads, but you're seeing strangeness in the weather too, aren't you? I mean, there's some really bizarre things that are unfolding. And, I don't want to read too much into this. I heard a freaky little story came out of Egypt, and I'm glad I don't live there right now. I'll tell you why. There was a storm there that brought rain and flooding, and of course, that part of the world is usually very dry. It's a dry area, the southern part of the country, and because of the rain, it forced scorpions out, and they wanted to seek shelter, and they went into people's houses, so they had this plague of scorpions, and more than 500 people were stung. They were injured. They needed to go to the hospital. They needed to get anti-venom after being stung by these scorpions who made their way into their home, into their shoes, into their beds. The venom, depending on the type of scorpion and how bad or how many stings you get, it can kill you within hours. So fortunately, no one died. Just we might have problems here, but boy, I'm glad I don't have scorpions to contend with. All right, well, look, let me take a break here. When I come back, we'll talk more. In fact, I want to give you an update on Kyle Rittenhouse, all that is unfolding there. You're more than welcome to join me, too. You know the number. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'm back with more right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. It's always good to talk with you. I mean that. We'll pray the chaplet coming up at the top of the next hour, so give me an early warning or some early heads up. Why not tell somebody else and have them join us? Let's pray for peace in Kenosha, right? Kenosha, Wisconsin. That was terrible what we saw. Kenosha, if you're not familiar with where it's located, it's a little town located between the city of Chicago and Milwaukee. And we remember the rioting, the looting, the burning, the destruction that took place in that as the governor of that state, Governor Evers, didn't intervene. The president at the time when he saw this unfolding was willing to provide help. This is help, but the problem is that there's so much political divide. So much political divide. For example, I don't know where you stand on the border wall, right? We have pieces of that border wall that are just being they're laying on the ground rusting because they're not being built. We're paying builders not to build it. I don't know how you feel about what's happening on the southern border. You might think that's a good thing, but millions of dollars a day being spent to watch that border wall just rust, just lay there, right? And no one will build that wall because in the Democratic Party, because they don't want to give Trump, they don't want to carry on his legacy or do anything that's positive with him. The same thing happened during that election cycle when President Trump saw the chaos in the country, was willing to go to a state which at one point voted for him. Now, of course, it went in Biden's direction in that particular election, and the Democratic governor wanted nothing to do with the help, so the people suffered. And, of course, a young man named Kyle Rittenhouse went there with a medical bag to try to help people, and also, unfortunately, he brought a gun with him, and things got out of control. You know the story. So his trial was underway. They heard closing arguments the other day, and they're still out right now. The jury has asked the judge a few questions, including looking into a video and getting copies of 36-page listing of instructions that the judge gave them before they went into deliberation. So they're taking their job very seriously, I'm assuming. The longer they deliberate, the worse it sometimes looks for the defendant. Experts are saying that it's not unusual, given how complex this trial is. There was a Fox News contributor and a National Review senior fellow, a man who's been on this program many times, a guy named Andy McCarthy. He's urging caution. Don't read too much in the tea leaves here in terms of what the jury's doing, he says. And he reminded people that the jury didn't see the exchange that the judge, I don't know if you saw it yesterday, Judge Schroeder's the guy's name, and the assistant district attorney, Thomas Binger, had. The judge berated, Binger, for questioning Rittenhouse's silence before his trial and actually trying to use that silence as a way to indict him. There have been a couple of motions right now for the judge to declare a mistrial with prejudice, meaning that Rittenhouse could never be arrested again in connection with the case, but the judge has not ruled on those motions yet. I just heard a story, too, before walking in the studio here, that apparently the defense was given a very low-grade quality of some of the footage, while the prosecution had very high-def aerial drone footage of actually what went down, and it never went to them, and that could be grounds also, again, for declaring a mistrial. But I'm joined right now by an attorney. James Herson joins me, New York Times bestselling author and, of course, a law professor, writes for the Left Coast Reports. You can follow him on his website at James Herson, HIRSEN.com, or follow him at the Jim Jams. That's his Twitter handle. James, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Good to be with you, Drew. Good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm well. I'm hanging there following this case. I'm hoping for peace. You know, I heard a lot of the protesters outside the courthouse chanting, no peace, no justice, or no justice, no peace, no justice, no peace. Some say they could hear it in there. I don't know whether it's going to influence the jury or not. I'd love your take as a law professor on what we're seeing unfold. Is it unusual to deliberate this long? And secondarily to that, what do you make of some of the claims people are calling for in terms of some things that have happened that might lead to a mistrial?
Well, as far as the jury deliberating, yeah, there's kind of an old saw that the longer they go, that means they're wrestling with it. Perhaps it's more likely that's possible there would be a hung jury, because remember, it only takes one juror to create a hung jury. But you never know what's going on inside that room. It's like it's the secret phase of the trial, and it's going to determine the outcome. And part of the reason is because there's multiple charges. You know, there's first of all, the judge dismissed what could have been a way for the jury to kind of split the baby, so to speak. And that was the misdemeanor charge. A weapons charge, a misdemeanor charge for inappropriately having a weapon across state lines. But it turned out that was not the law, so the judge dismissed it. So the next highest charge is a reckless endangerment of the public with a weapon charge. But that's a 12-year plus prison sentence. It's still a serious conviction. But if the jury does anything other than the top charges, the intentional homicide charges, I'm afraid that, and that's why we do have to pray, I'm afraid that the community, the instigators that have traveled to the city of Kenosha may, you know, engage, act up, and cause problems. And this is the thing about this case, based on the evidence we know that's been reported, based on the way the prosecution's case went. Remember, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. That is as close to 100% proof as we can get. If there's any doubt, reasonable doubt, that the defense can argue, then the jury cannot convict. That doesn't mean the defendant's not guilty, but that means that the prosecution has not met their burden. If this wasn't a high-profile media case where much of the media had made up their mind, and wrongfully so, not given this young man the presumption of innocence, and even the president of the United States not doing so, if it had been a low-profile case, normally a jury would not be able to render a verdict of guilty. I mean, after all, the central question on those intentional claims and even the reckless claim is, did Kyle Rittenhouse experience circumstances where he was in fear that his life was in danger? If the answer is yes, then the self-defense knocks out those counts that the prosecution is relying on, and this is an acquittal. And based on the evidence, even the prosecution's evidence, the witnesses went against the notion that the prosecution was stating that somehow a young Rittenhouse, 17-year-old, was not reasonably in fear of his life or real serious bodily harm. And so I just think the thing that is the focus of the media and is the intimidation that is potentially influencing jurors that you mentioned, Andy McCarthy, that's his concern. These people that are outside of the courthouse where the jury is deliberating, chanting with bullhorns, getting lots of press coverage. I mean, it's just, it's a problem in high profile cases always, but in this one, because of the politics and because of the fact that it has been labeled in racial terms, ridiculously so, because the defendant and the victims are all one race. But notwithstanding that, I think we pray for two things. One is that justice is done by an impartial jury, not influenced by these external forces. And two, as you pointed out, we pray for peace in Kenosha. And those two things would be miraculous, but we know, you know, that our God is capable of providing miracles, and that's why you have the Divine Mercy segment.
Amen to that. Well, James, I don't know how much time you have. I need to take a short break here. You have time to hang with us, or you have to run? I don't know how much time you have.
I will hang, Drew.
All right, well, stay with us. We'll come back. We'll grab a call or two. I only have a few moments, though, today. We've got a pretty full show. If you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. Just giving you some analysis on what's now unfolding in Kenosha, Wisconsin. One of the big questions will be, what happens depending how this verdict comes down? We'll look at that as well. Take your calls. Continue our conversation with James Herson right after this. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. If you're just getting plugged in, we'll pray the chaplet coming up in about 30 minutes. We've got a lot more to talk about, and I'm joined today by James Herson, a law professor, a very gifted writer, musician, a man of many talents. We're just taking a look at the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. I had thought that the verdict would have been in, that we'd probably be seeing what would unfold afterwards, and maybe even give you some analysis on what this means. James, I want to go to the phones. Before I do, I just want your take on what you think might be coming. If the verdict goes for indictment, what do you think will happen? If he is somehow exonerated and set free, how do you think that will play out? So maybe give me those two scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's an indictment, and if it's one of the top counts, in other words, involving intentional homicide or an attempt towards intentional homicide, Intentional homicide in Wisconsin is a mandatory life sentence. It's a very serious verdict. If it was the attempt or one of the other lesser charges that require 60, 65 years in prison, then I think the community is placated and it's likely to be peaceful, but it's not going to be peaceful for, you know, the defense lawyers, for the public at large who's watched this trial, would view it as an intimidated jury. And of course they would appeal if in fact it's one of the lesser charges that still are, would be serious to Kyle Rittenhouse and for, you know, a dozen years or more in prison for reckless endangerment to the public and use of a dangerous weapon. I'm afraid that it's bad for everyone. It would be a somewhat intimidated jury that's compromising. And I don't think the community will be peaceful necessarily, although I pray that they would. I also believe, you know, they would appeal that. And so it's very obviously that an acquittal is the proper verdict based on the evidence. And that would mean an unintimidated jury. And then it would take a miracle to keep Kenosha from experiencing more of what they experienced in the summer of 2020, riots and destruction of property and people possibly getting hurt. It's a terrible situation. And it's something that, you know, I mean, it should have been tried somewhere else. Really, in my view.
I agree.
But those are you know, obviously I've set forth all the possible outcomes, but my prayer is an acquittal in peace. That's the miracle. And maybe somehow that will happen through a miracle.
Well, let's grab a couple quick calls. Lisa's listening in Wheaton, Illinois. Greg's been waiting in Minnesota. Ernest in California. Lisa, good afternoon. I'll start with you.
Hi, I have a question about the motion to dismiss that's still open. And how does that work? If that motion is still open and the jury returns a verdict, say guilty, can the judge, based on the way the trial went and the evidence, which seems so overwhelmingly that Kyle acted in self-defense, can the judge still rule after the jury returns a verdict to dismiss the case?
Yeah, I think the judge can declare a mistrial all the way up, even possibly after the verdict. But I don't, you know, if the judge hasn't declared the mistrial by now and is leaving the motion open, I think that's kind of a sign that the judge doesn't want to do that for whatever reason. And, you know, the judge has had already, it's reported that the judge has had threats to family members, to himself. You know, the social media statements on the judge have been horrendous.
Right.
Terrible. And the media themselves, the reporting on the judge has been ridiculously slanted and biased. And they're declaring him, he might as well be Judge David Duke, according to the media. So, it should be, by the way, legally speaking, based on what the prosecution did in after asked not to, commenting, which goes against the Constitution and the written law of the state, and that is commenting and trying to get the jury to infer guilt from the silence of the defendant. That is so basic, so wrong. From a legal point of view, that should have been a mistrial right there. And the defense didn't move for it at that time, but then they did later. But because everyone knows, I mean, people watch movies and television shows, and what's the first thing that the police say to the defendant? You have the right to remain silent. I mean, this is part of our constitutional rights. It's something actually it's given to us by God, and it's, you know, basically the government is prevented from interfering with those rights. And so this is, but it is we're in a strange situation there in Kenosha. And, you know, I don't believe, if I had to predict, I don't think the judge is going to take it away from the jury in any way.
No, me either. At least a thank you. Let me just move along because I only have a couple minutes. I want to get to my next guest as well. Greg in Minnesota has been waiting to join you. Greg, good afternoon. You're on the air with James Herson.
Hey, Drew. Say, I'd like to say I love your show, and thanks for leading me to the Divine Mercy Chaplet. My question is, anything but a guilty plea is probably going to lead to riots. And I was just kind of curious what the difference would be between riots and it being a terroristic act, you know, kind of like they claim it was a terroristic act in January there in Washington. So I was just kind of curious what the difference would be.
That's a great, great question, you know, especially when we live in a time where we have the Attorney General directing investigators to conduct terrorism investigations on parents who appear in front of school boards. And I think your point is well taken. It's far more serious when people commit crimes, destroy property, injure people, than it is, you know, obviously for people to express their First Amendment rights protesting in Washington, D.C., or parents expressing their concerns over their children and what their children are taught. But, you know, this is the thing. I mean, we live in a time where rights are enshrined in our founding documents are disrespected and cast aside.
Yeah. Well, James, I got to leave it right there. Thank you for being with us. I'm always grateful for your time, for your insight. We'll see what happens. The fact that this has gone for 2 days, it could turn into three before we know it. You think that's a good sign or a bad sign for Kyle?
It normally is a good sign if they take longer. It normally means a greater possibility, not a probability, but a possibility of a hung jury. And maybe that will be the result, and then maybe the prosecution might, in that town, think twice about going forward with a second prosecution, especially since the first one shouldn't have been brought at all.
All right, we'll have to see. James, thanks. I hope people follow you online at your website. Of course, your Twitter handle, at Jim Jams. That's right? That's the Twitter handle for you? At the Jim Jams?
Yes, it is.
I always love that. Hey, we'll talk again. Keep up your good work, okay?
All right. God bless you, Drew. Thank you for your great work.
You.
And thank you for moving that divine mercy forward.
Amen. That's James Herson. And I'll tell you what, let me take a short pause here. Welcome back. I'm going to be joined by Father Dave Haney. And we'll get his perspective as well. If you have a troubled marriage, I was thinking about this recently. You know, there's a place in the gospel where marriage was front and center. And we'll talk about that and maybe ways you can find healing. Stay with us. We're back with more right after this.
And you seek, seek my face, your face, O God, I see.
Well, thanks for being here with me. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll pray the chapel. Let's pray for marriage today. You know, I've been talking a lot about the Holy Land lately, and it's such an enchanted, such a special place. I love it. I shared with you yesterday the story of the pools of blood that showed up in Gethsemane. Very powerful sign, to say the least, witnessed by a number of pilgrims a couple years ago. Of course, there were weeping icons in Bethlehem, at the very birthplace of Christ. I was thinking about Cana earlier today. You know, Fox News covered something that was trending on social media the other day. They picked up on an Instagram post that got a lot of attention. It came across my radar. There was a wedding photographer who said that there were three signs that you'll see at a wedding that will indicate whether your marriage is going to last or not, whether it'll last very long. So if you're ready to get married or you're going to somebody's wedding, check this out. The first indicator, they said, is that one of the spouses will take more than three family photos with the other spouse. The second is when the wedding party avoids talking about the other spouse during the get ready photos or toast, which means they don't really like that chosen spouse. And then the third, the last indicator, is that one of the spouses will spend more time with friends and family at the reception rather than with their new spouse. So keep an eye out for those. Now, there is a world famous wedding, right, where there was no photographer present, but there were some guests that were there that, you know, made a big difference at the wedding. You know what I'm talking about, right? It was that wedding feast at Cana in Galilee. Mary was invited as a guest, and I guess Jesus and his disciples were too. Pretty big bash, right? Had all these people coming, and you know the story. They ran out of wine. Huge embarrassment for the groom. Oh my gosh, how humiliating! So Mary goes to Jesus and asks him to intervene to save this couple from the humiliation, from the shame that will come upon them. And Jesus says, Mom, woman, it's not my time. My time hasn't come yet, right? I was always struck by that. Father Haney is going to be joining me in a second. I'd like to get his take on this as well, because did Christ know when his public ministry was about to begin? Did Mary somehow, through the power of her intercession, accelerate that timeline, or maybe even elongate Christ's public ministry? So we don't hear any other exchange. All we know is that she goes to the servant and says to them, do whatever my son tells you to do. And after that, you know, Christ tells them to put water into 6 stone water jars and draw it out and take it to the head waiter. And the head waiter tells the groom that, what's the matter with you? Yeah, you served the best wine last. It should be the other way around. This is unbelievable. Of course, it was made by the master sommelier, right? The master vintner, Jesus Christ. Probably the best wine ever in the world. And the party continued. And of course, that is symbolic also. The story is just packed with so many other things. A sacramental marriage, the bride and groom getting ready to receive the body and blood of Christ, a foreshadowing of Christ turning wine and bread into his body and blood. So let's talk a little bit about it right now. I'm joined by Father Dave Haney. He's the pastor of St. Bruno's Parish in Whittier, California, and an amateur archaeologist leading archaeological pilgrimages to the Holy Land every year. And he's back once again just to shed a little insight on this powerful site known as Cana. And I know a lot of people there often go and they renew their wedding vows. And I thought, man, that would be so cool to do with your spouse. Go to Cana and redo your wedding vows. Father, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Thanks for having me, and I am delighted that you're going to the Holy Land soon.
Yeah, and thank you for your patience, Father, by the way. Thank you very much. I know you've been to Cana many times. Let's talk a little bit about that. I know couples probably always renew their wedding vows there. When people go to the Holy Land, do we know the place where this miracle actually happened? I can understand the claim for, you know, the Sea of Galilee or the Mount of the Beatitudes or Tabor or places like that, but this is a pretty interesting story. Do we really know where the wedding happened?
Well, it's a reasonable candidate where the modern-day Cana village is now and where the church is that all the pilgrims go to renew their wedding vows. That's a reasonable candidate. About 5 miles away, there's another candidate. It's actually a ruin. There's nobody living there. But both places have similar archaeological evidence. Very often in the early church, you know, pilgrims, they wanted to build a church on a place where a gospel story occurred. And it was a way of making it sacred. It was a way of preserving it, making it a place of prayer. So one of the earliest signs of authenticity is there a church? And these two places both have churches, both ancient churches, and they both have kind of memorialized 30-gallon wine jars. A 30-gallon wine jar is about the size of your standard household, you know, garbage pail that you would put out on the street once a week. And both places have remains of these classic 30-gallon wine jars. So we don't have anything more than that. Just kind of the standard early church, practices and behaviors that would kind of, you know, designate a place as authentic. So those are the two top candidates. They're about 5 miles apart. But either one has a pretty good claim.
We hear the same thing, don't we, though, about the tomb? You know, I was always struck by that because I'm struck by how close where Christ was crucified was and where you go to claim the Holy Sepulchre is. I mean, they're incredibly close. You know, I would have thought, they took his body down, they carried him a long way. But I know our Protestant brothers and sisters believe that the tomb's in a different place. I know we're not going to talk about that, but maybe you can share a little bit of that.
Yeah, first of all, no one believes in the Protestant tomb anymore, even the Protestants. Even the Church of England, which used to control it, actually sold it because it doesn't have any archaeological evidence whatsoever. But Cana and the tomb are on two completely different archaeological levels. And this is the most amazing thing. This is really, I think, a really true miracle. It turns out that the most, absolutely most archaeologically verified site in all of the Holy Land is the crucifixion and resurrection site. Wow. And with the resurrection site even being stronger from a recent discovery just a few years ago. So the very center of our faith, it turns out, has the most archaeological verification. So if you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you know, it's it's an old church, it's dark, it's noisy, it's not very edifying from a devotional viewpoint. But you can be absolutely sure that you are in the place, and if you're lucky enough to get inside, you are absolutely in the place that is archaeologically determined to be the place where Jesus was buried and he rose from the dead. That's an amazing miracle.
That is so cool to be able to just pray there and be there where Christ's body was. Amazing. The wedding feast, I want to go back. I'm curious about a couple of things. Christ says, woman, it's not my time. Our Lady's intercession, I think it speaks to how powerful it is, right? That what she asked of her son, he is so willing to do. And of course, you know, this began his public ministry. It would ultimately lead to his death. Can you explain a little bit about what was happening in this particular moment?
Absolutely. First of all, this is the most important event that occurred in a village. Maybe because when a couple gets married, that means there's a new family. And a new family means children, and it means the village will survive. So this wedding is more than a happy event. It is a powerfully meaningful event for a village, because this meant the future is going to happen. We're going to have a new family and children. Now, Jesus does his first miracle at the wedding feast of Cana. But, you know, the Bible starts with a marriage. It ends with the wedding reception of the Lamb. And the entire relationship between God and humankind, the entire Bible uses the image of a marriage where God is the groom and we are the bridegroom, or we are the bride. So this is, Jesus is making a very, very important statement about marriage here. And one of the most beautiful, heartwarming things is he wants to make sure the party continues. You know, if the wine runs out, people go home. And so by doing this beautiful miracle, you know, obviously it's an important miracle, it's needed for hospitality, but it's also a metaphor of way of saying that Jesus wants people to fall in love, he wants their love to continue, and he wants it to be a celebration, a happy, happy event. So, Mary and Jesus, they certainly saved the day.
Yeah. You know, it's also foreshadowing Christ, of Christ, you know, turning bread and wine into his body and blood. There's so much packed in this early story here. Those stone jars, you know, that St. John mentions in his account of the wedding, how much wine do they hold? I'm just curious. They were filled with wine, and I just got, you know, I love wine. I think it had to be the best, you know, vintage ever. How much wine did Christ make? Anybody ever calculate that or think about that?
It's about 180 gallons, 180, wow. Almost 200 gallons of wine. Now, they had all these water jars because, you know, Jewish purification practices, you were constantly having to wash your hands or your feet, you know, throughout the day for purification according to kosher laws. So Jesus takes these large water jars and turns them into wine. And it really is a symbol of abundance. You know, this is just going to be a tremendous party. Just a abundant joy is going to happen from this, you know, tremendous gift of not only a lot of wine, but exceptionally good wine. And Jesus is recalling the prophecy from Isaiah, when Isaiah talks about the time of the Messiah will come when, you know, there will be abundant joy and a lot of wine. And Isaiah specifically says a lot of wine, and here's Jesus making it actually happen at that wedding feast of Cana. Abundant wine, abundant joy, and of high, high quality.
Yeah, I also think about his apostles. I'm sure Christ worked other miracles, you know, prior to this. They say this is his first public one. I am sure if they made 200 gallons of wine, mm-hmm. The word gets out pretty quick when the waiters and people are saying, "Oh my gosh, I swear, I'm the guy. I got the water. I'm the one who filled. This was water. You can't believe it. It turned into wine." Yeah. The buzz throughout that village must have spread pretty quickly. I'm sure the wine did too. Everybody probably came to witness it, and I'm sure this had a profound impact on his apostles.
Well, yeah. I mean, everything that Jesus said and did just kind of cemented that relationship with the apostles with Jesus. I'm not sure that they understood everything he said or understood everything he did, but they knew that this was a person from God who was of God. And, their understanding came later, of course, with the Holy Spirit, but they knew they were in on something really, really important and really big with this very, very public miracle at Cana. And it really is also a way of Mary saying to Jesus, you know, although it's the bridegroom at the wedding's job to make the wine, Mary is really saying to Jesus, you are the bridegroom, just affirming. We know that you are the bridegroom that the entire scriptures talk about, and your hour has come. And what does that hour mean? Of course, the hour always means the passion and death of Jesus and the resurrection, which always brings an abundance of grace, an abundance of joy. You know, Pope Benedict used to say all the time that the real sign of that you have the presence of Jesus within you is this deep, profound joy. And that certainly is the spirit, that's certainly the attitude, that's certainly what's going on at the wedding feast of Cana. Abundant joy, 200 gallons of wine. Yeah. The party is just beginning, and Jesus wants it to continue.
I wonder whatever happened to the bride and the groom. You know, I think about how marriage today is so troubled. You know, there's such disorientation, confusion over what marriage really means, what it's about, the sacramentality of that. Even Catholics and Christians themselves don't really, I think, embrace and understand the sacramentality of all this. I wonder if they became followers of Christ, if they are in heaven today, because what powerful ancestors they would be, especially if somebody's listening now who has a troubled marriage. You know, they're praying to save it, or where there's infidelity, or maybe they're discerning that vocation. You know, Cana is a holy place and a special place.
That couple at Cana, they did the smart thing. They invited Jesus. And so really every couple has to invite Jesus. You have to invite Jesus into your marriage, right, just like that first couple did. And then you will also begin to have that abundant joy. And you have to make new wine. You have to keep committing. You have to renew your vows to each other. Just don't think that, you know, one promise on one day is enough. You have to really do it over and over again. Really, in the way that Jesus made new wine, you have to renew your love as well by always renewing your commitment to each other over and over again.
I love it. So well said. Hey, Father, thank you. Thanks for your time. I know how busy you are, and it's good to have you stop by. You're welcome here anytime. And appreciate your perspective. Look forward to the next time we get a chance to talk. And your buddy Joe looks forward to getting together with you, he told me.
That sounds great. Perfect. All right.
All right.
God bless.
We'll catch up, Father. All right. It is time to pray the chaplet. Stay with me when we come back. We will pray more. All right. We'll pray for your marriage. We'll pray for this country. We'll pray for your needs and your intentions. Feel free to dial in. It's 888-914-9149. That's, of course, Father Dave Haney. Be right back.